Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 147 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and as usual, I have three other airplane geeks with me. First up is Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Hey, good evening. Hey, glad to be here. I'm back from beautiful downtown West Lafayette, Indiana, where I attended a graduation. My nephew became was commissioned an ensign in the Navy. And David, I was thinking about you when we had all these ROTC guys and girls, probably about 80 of them, picking up their bars and epaulets and things. It was all the music and it was really cool.
Fantastic.
My question, though, Rob, which I asked you earlier in the week, is in addition to everything, you know, everything military related, did you give him a graduation Jetwine button?
Actually, he already had a Jetwine button. What I did tell him, though, is I got him really excited, and I told him there was soon going to be an Airplane Geeks button.
Yeah. Oh,
we're not supposed to talk about that
coming
yet,
soon.
Are we?
We'll talk about it soon.
Coming soon, yes. We'll talk about that.
Also with us is David Vanderhoof from the What Just Flew By blog. David, you're back from someplace, too, I think.
Yeah, I put close to 750 miles on my beloved little Grand Am, drove down to Langley Air Force Base in Hampton Roads, Virginia on Friday morning, spent Friday afternoon on base and followed it up with all day yesterday in base, then drove home. Had great show. Unfortunately, that the largest Raptor base in the world had all of its Raptors grounded, but there was plenty of sights to see, some really good interviews I scored. Greg Poe, an aerobatic pilot, professional aerobatic pilot, he flies a aircraft completely on ethanol, which was kind of cool.
Oh, nice.
The Misty Blues, the all-female parachute team.
Uh-huh.
Some more interviews about NASA. I found out that Rob's favorite airplane is so easy to fly, it can be flown without a pilot. NASA Langley is using an SR-22 as their unmanned aerial vehicle test aircraft. They have a guy that sits in the back seat as a pilot on board just in case, but basically they're flying it around Langley airspace with nobody aboard, flown from the ground.
Interesting.
So,
yeah.
UAVs are coming soon, folks. So it was a good show.
All right. And we're going to hear more from David from the show in a little bit. But first, let me introduce the third little airplane geek amongst us.
Little?
Young airplane geek. Younger. That, of course, is Dan Webb from the Things in the Sky blog. Hi, Dan. You haven't been anywhere lately, have you?
No, and I feel slightly sorry for myself now as a result. But
Dan, you came home.
I am done with school, yes. So that is an achievement, I suppose.
Good. When does the job start, the summer job?
A couple weeks.
All right. Well, at long last, let me introduce our guest for this episode. That's Todd McClamrock from the My Flight blog.
Great to meet you guys. How you doing?
Now, I understand My Flight blog is one of the longest running general aviation blogs around. Is that true?
Yeah, I started it back in 2004, and there weren't many around at the time.
No.
I'm glad to say that there's a lot more now. It's great to have some company of other fellow bloggers to interact with.
What motivated you to start the blog?
You know, I was learning to fly and kind of looked around for other sources of information about, you know, what it costs to learn to fly, how you choose a flight school, those types of things. And there were some forums, but there really weren't a lot of kind of personal descriptions of what it takes to go about earning your pilot's license.
Right.
So I decided what better way to do that than kind of document it as I went. And I had a lot of fun doing it. It's been a lot of fun.
It's a great blog. Very interesting stuff. We're going to talk about some of the topics that you've been talking about in the recent past. But coming up first, we're going to talk about the week's aviation news. After that, we'll talk with Todd about some GA and some other aviation topics. Then David's going to bring us an interview with Billy Deal from Lockheed Martin, talk about the F-35 lift fan system. And we've got the Australia Desk report. It's a bit different this week. Grant tries to swap out Steve's. I'm not going to say anything more. You'll just have to listen for that. It's pretty amusing. And Peter Johnson's got his Across the Pond segment on European aviation. And he talks with Diego Lopez Salazar from the Spanish aviation podcast, Aero Podcast. So we'll look forward to that. And we'll close out with a little bit of listener mail. First, let's get started with some aviation news. Everybody ready?
Ready.
Jack.
Our first story was actually suggested by a listener, that being Carlos. This is Delayed by Bigotry. It's from The Economist. This article reports that Atlantic Southeast Airlines was on a flight or had begun a flight from Memphis to Charlotte that included two Muslim passengers who were, in fact, headed to a conference on anti-Muslim prejudice. Well, it seems that the pilot decided that he didn't want these two individuals on his plane and returned to the gate, had the two individuals removed from the flight. And that was kind of that. I don't know. First of all, and probably Rob can talk to this, and also Todd, I mean, the pilot has the right to make decisions like this. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the pilot in command is the final authority of what goes on once everybody's on board. However, My guess is that after this happened, the chief pilot for that particular base, wherever he was out of, probably had a few things to say to the pilot man or woman, whoever they were. Because at least the story, as we understand it, doesn't seem to indicate that these people were even remotely a threat, other than the way they were dressed.
Yeah, and you know, I've tried to follow up in the news and search around to see if there was more to the story. Because from the initial reports, it kind of does read like something that there's more to it than what was reported. But I can't find anything. I think you're right, Rob. It just seems that the pilot didn't like these two. Now, granted, this was a couple days, I think, after Osama bin Laden had been killed. So maybe there was sort of heightened sensitivity, but still, I don't know. This just doesn't feel right.
Well, you know what's interesting, too, is that there was a follow-up story in one of the Charlotte papers. And of course, most of the newspapers kind of post all these stories as a blog these days so people can comment. And they shut down the comments on the story because of the ugly language that was being sent as a comment. So, who knows who started it or why, but it looks like it was kind of a false alarm.
Yeah, and I don't know what's going to happen. I think that these two individuals are investigating options that they might take to get some sort of redress for the problem that they had as a result of this. But
That's the problem. They needed to redress.
that's not what I was.
I'm sorry. You walked right into that.
I guess I did.
Oh man! See what you've got going here, Todd. Now you have to be ready for all kinds of things like that.
I'm literally insane
been instructed.
Right now.
And I believe you instructed me that you're in charge of the funny stuff.
Yeah, okay, sorry.
That's true.
Right.
And we should, we need a disclaimer here, though. Todd and I are both members of the same flying club here in Chicago. And although Todd and I have never actually flown together, we do occasionally see each other. And so I am somewhat inclined to agree with everything you say, Todd. Just
appreciate
I mention that. Okay.
So this is like probably the first time I'll ever say this and ever say it ever on the blog on the podcast.
What's that, Dan?
Is let's get back on topic.
Sorry. Okay.
I do have to give kudos to Delta here because even though the flight was operated by ASA, it was a Delta connection flight, and I was very happy to see on Delta's blog a few days ago. Delta's director of customer care actually put up a blog post about the situation. So there's a few paragraphs, but I think the last line sums it up. He says, and I say, quote, although we were not the operators of the flight, these passengers are our customers, and we would like to join Atlantic Southeast once again in offering an apology for any impact the situation had on both them and their travel. And they provided some more commentary before that. But I was just happy to see that the mainline carrier, even though they weren't operating the flight to still address the issue publicly.
Yeah, that's good. I like that. That seems an appropriate thing to do. All right, next story. This is from USA Today. No explanation for outbreak of insanity on planes. It seems that we have three passengers recently who've tried to open the cabin or the cockpit doors while in flight. In one example, we had an attempt by a 43-year-old to open the emergency door on a Delta Airlines flight, an Airbus A320. The passengers in that case said he'd been drinking and appeared upset when the flight was late. He was arrested by police. And then also on American Airlines, the article notes that flight attendants and passengers subdued a Yemeni native who was screaming and pounding on a cockpit door of a Boeing 737-800 jet before it was scheduled to land in San Francisco. He was also arrested, been charged. I think he's being held without bail. And then the third case was Continental Airlines. This was flight 546. Article says was diverted to St. Louis after a passenger tried to open a cabin door and was subdued by flight attendants and passengers. So I don't know. I guess it's just sort of the luck of statistics that we have this rash of folks trying to open doors on airplanes, right? Does anyone think there's anything going on here?
You're not supposed to open the door on the airplane while in flight?
Not usually, not advisable.
You can't anyway.
Yeah, it's a lockout.
Isn't an interlock on there that won't let you do it? But gee, I'll tell you, I had a passenger once that had that was claustrophobic, and they were sitting in the back, and everything was fine until the door closed, and the woman lost her mind. And the other pilot said, or the flight attendant said, we've got to try and calm this woman down. I said, baloney, man. I said, we are not flying this airplane with this lady on board, because it was that insane.
Yeah.
And until you've seen somebody like that, you just can't imagine what in the world got them all fired up. And sometimes you have no idea at all. I mean, and I don't know that we know. We'll probably never know on these people.
The thing that struck me as I was starting to read through the article, and before I got to the end where they actually do bring it up, but the thing that struck me was that, in cases like this, not only flight attendants, but passengers are actively getting involved in subduing folks who are doing things like this, which I think is kind of interesting. I mean, I think that, pre-9/11, I'm not sure that would happen that often. But since then, the general public, what you might call the general public, is much more eager to, react to situations like this. And I don't know if that's good or bad.
Eager. I'm not sure if I'd say eager, but I think more people are now resigned to the fact that when they're on an airplane, they're not nearly as out of control as they used to think they were. And that they're not going to let someone try something like that did on 9/11, at least not easily. And so in that sense, there's a good and a bad to that. I mean, if I was up in front, I'd always be worried about people taking, some kind of a vigilante stance, because you never know for sure if it's legitimate or not. But I guess in the end, those people are there and they see it the way they see it. And as long as they're not depressurizing the cabin or killing somebody, I guess it can't be that bad, can it?
No, I mean, I try to put myself in that situation. And if I'm watching somebody do something that's really threatening, I don't know. I think that these days I'm just more likely to, step up and try to do something. But, like you say, I mean, this could be a problem if people start stepping up to things that maybe there's nothing to step up to, or there's no reason to step up to it. And maybe our first article is, could have been an example of something like that. These two guys in wearing, one was wearing Indian clothing and the other was wearing Arab clothing, as I understand it. And, if people start reacting irrationally and, taking some kind of action based on that, it could be problematic. But I guess I don't think we've seen that happen so far.
Have you tried to travel with your youngins yet, Todd, on an airplane?
Yeah, we're actually seasoned travelers. We've traveled 4 or 5 times with them. It was a lot easier when they were kind of happy to sit in your lap for 2 or 3 hours. But now that they're learning to walk, it's getting a lot more complicated.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, when they get mobile, that's when the fun starts.
Yeah, we may be grounded for a few years now.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, next article comes from Flight Global. FAA updates proposed air carrier crew training rules. Now, the FAA has issued some, pretty significant updates to the flight attendant and dispatcher training rules that had previously been published in January 2009, actually. And I guess this was motivated by two things, according to this article, that some legislation was passed by the U.S. Congress that mandated ground and flight training recognition in stall avoidance and recovery, and also as a result of many comments that the FAA received concerning these changes. So what do you think? Is this are they better now than they were before? You don't care.
I just think this is the stupidest thing going. I'm sorry.
What's stupid?
Well, you know what? We did all this anyway. I mean, I'm sorry. I don't think we need another. This reminds me of the handgun thing in a sense. I mean, when there's a problem, someone says we need more laws against guns. And you can't legislate people doing stupid things. And my guess is that if they went back and looked, because I think this all kind of evolved from that crash in Buffalo.
The Colgan Air crash.
Yeah, the Colgan Air one. Yes. And you know what? I'll bet you if they looked through the training records, in fact, I believe that's where this came from, is that they found out that these people had not been trained in aircraft stalls and stall recovery and, you know, all the stuff that now Todd's a brand new pilot here. Well, not brand new. How long have you had your license, Todd?
6 years now.
6 years, yeah. So he's like an old guy now. But, you know, I mean, we train everybody in that. And even when you're in a big airplane, they train you that way. So telling people that there's a new law that says we have to do something that's already in the training syllabus is just silly. Call it what it is. Say the company screwed up, or that the trainer or the instructor that was working with them didn't show them what they were supposed to do, and get on with it. But another law? Oh, my Lord. I'm sorry. It's just dumb.
This article says that the FAA received 3,000 pages of comments in response to the first version of this rule. 3,000 pages. I don't even know how they, you know, managed to process something like that volume. How many of those pages were yours, Rob? Me?
No, actually, just a couple.
Just a couple. Okay.
Well, actually, one cool thing, speaking of the number of comments, what's great is there's a great website, regulations.gov, and you can
see search. This, right?
Yeah, you can go through the comment process and see what people are saying and see, go through all the DOT or the FAA in this case, all the rationale for the rule. So it's actually I find it fun, but I'm assuming normal people might not find it fun, but it's a great way to...
It's probably interesting.
I think it's a very good website. It's a great way to keep track of what's going on.
And what's that called again?
Regulations.gov, and it's obviously not just for the aviation stuff.
Right.
I believe all... I'm guessing here, but I believe all the major federal departments are on there, so...
Okay. Let's move on to Aviation Week. Have an article called GA Avgas Coalition Vows to Fight Avgas Lawsuit. There's a group called the Center for Environmental Health, or the CEH, and they're based in California. And they give a notice that they plan to sue for violation of California's drinking water and toxic enforcement law. Now, what the CEH says is, and I'll quote what's in the article, ordinary use of the leaded aviation fuel supplied by the alleged violators results in discharges or releases of lead into water or onto land, where lead passes, or probably will pass, into a source of drinking water. So the CEH plans to file a lawsuit. There is the General Aviation Avgas Coalition, and they say that they're going to fight that, this lawsuit, which is against about 50 fuel retailers and suppliers in California. Well, first of all, you guys tell me, leaded fuel for general aviation aircraft. I mean, that's kind of a must, isn't it?
I'm going to stay silent on this. Let Dan jump in there.
So how much of general aviation uses leaded gas?
All of it.
All of it.
Yeah, it really does. We're stuck. I mean, and unfortunately, as much as the industry would like to say they are being environmentally clean, sound, what have you, right now there is not an alternative that alternative fuel in widespread development that can produce the octane ratings that these high compression engines need to operate. And of course, what they can get them to do down low, as in some of the home builds, the ones that tool around at maybe, you know, 1 or 2,000 feet off the ground, can run pretty well on auto gas if they're converted. But the high compression ones that we take up above 10,000 feet, Bonanzas, Barons, they just won't run. They just won't run. And so it's a problem, because there are some environmentalists out there that say, hey, it's time, you know, these aviation people, you know, pulled their weight and got rid of this damn lead, and we don't have a way to fix it yet.
So this isn't exactly the same as, you know, maybe when was it, in the early 70s, maybe, that automotive gasoline started moving away from leaded gasoline to lead-free gasoline. There was a, you know, big hue and cry from the auto manufacturers about how difficult this was going to be and all this. And of course, you know, now we have unleaded gas pretty much exclusively here in the U.S. But this is different, right? This is different because there is no alternative.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, they've had some success. My guess is they will eventually figure out a way to solve the problem. The chemistry is just not there yet. I mean, they because what we actually use is so that people that may not be aviation people understand, we're not using pure leaded fuel the way that we used to in automobiles 25 years ago. We're in a low lead situation. I could not honestly tell you the percentage of lead that is in low lead versus standard leaded fuel. But what they're also looking at as an option is perhaps to go to a lower lead fuel. And except that everybody kind of sees the writing on the wall and says, you know, we don't have that kind of time. And that's really what the concern is.
Well, I guess we'll follow this suit if, in fact, it does get filed, because I don't know if it'll have interesting repercussions or if it'll just get tossed out because it's just a crazy kind of a suit. It'll be interesting to follow.
Precisely.
Okay, another GA story. This is from Cincinnati.com.
Oh, well, no wonder Dan isn't saying anything.
That's because we're talking GA right now. He's working on some other calculations.
We've got to have an airline story in here somewhere.
I'm just busy absorbing all of your knowledge.
All right, well, here's some more knowledge. This is about this is from Cincinnati.com. General aviation shipments continue to decline. Now, this is based on some information that was published recently by GAMA, the General Aviation Manufacturers Association. And it says that in the first 3 months of 2011, total general aviation airplane shipments fell 4.6%. Also, that billings for aviation airplanes totaled $3.7 billion for the first 3 months, which sounds not bad, except that's down nearly 20%. They did break out in this article some detail behind it. It noted that piston-powered airplane shipments actually saw a 13.3% increase, though that was offset by turboprop shipments down 6.7%, and get this, business jet shipments down 22%. So that led to the overall decline in GA shipments for the first quarter of 2011. So I don't know. Does it sound like GA it sounds like GA is not coming out of the recession yet, but I'm wondering if they will.
I think they will. I don't know if it'll ever get back to where it used to be. And of course, the used to be. I mean, I'm old enough to remember back in the 70s when, you know, they were building 16 or 17,000 airplanes a year. And now if we can get into the, you know, the 1,000 or 2,000 airplanes a year, they'd be really astounded. But no, we're not there yet. And I think we're still seeing, certainly on the business jet side, we're seeing the results of orders that were canceled last year and the year before. And there are these holes in the production line now that simply have not been filled. And, you know, when it's going to come back, I don't know. But let's look at the housing market in the United States, too. It's still in trouble. I mean, and every time you think, well, they finally hit bottom, next month comes a report that says housing starts or, you know, the housing market is still down and still dropping. And it's just, it's probably not free fall, but boy, it's not pretty.
I would think that business jets are on kind of a different dynamic than piston-powered airplanes, I guess. I mean, I'm thinking piston-powered airplanes means more the private pilot kind of thing. And, you know, maybe that has different factors that determine, you know, what shipments are like, what sales are like. Whereas business jets, that's something different. Yeah, I don't know. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, probably a good number of the piston airplanes are flight training airplanes. Some of the schools perhaps replacing their fleets, that sort of thing. And then, as you said, by the time you get to a 10 or a 20 or a $30 million business jet, it's a much more serious matter. And companies, again, that canceled a couple of years ago are just now sort of saying, well, maybe we need to rethink that. And, you know, so again, when I was just down in Wichita a couple of weeks ago, walking through the Cessna line where they're building the CJ4s, and they were pretty busy. They're turning out a lot of airplanes, but you know that it's just not the pace that they were used to before.
Right. All right, let's see if we can draw David in a little bit with an article from Gizmag.com of all things.
Gizmag.
This is about an Aero Gizmo, the Firebird. Articles titled Firebird Intelligence Gathering Aircraft Makes Pilots an Optional Extra. Now, this is kind of interesting. This is about the Northrop Grumman aircraft. It's called the Firebird. And, you know, before we've talked about, well, obviously piloted vehicles, but also UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles, and remotely piloted vehicles, RPVs. Well, this is a category that's, I don't know, new to me. OPVs, optionally piloted vehicle. It's an aircraft that can either fly unpiloted or piloted. David, it's kind of an interesting option. I mean, it sort of, you know, splits the two. Is this something that's going to be useful to the military anyway?
Oh, I think so. Already we have some optional piloted vehicles already. They've worked with Bell has a Jet Ranger and the OH-58. That they're going to use as an optionally piloted vehicle.
Yeah,
we've talked about using helicopters for vertical replenishment, and depending upon the severity of what you're carrying or slinging, you could either do it by unmanned, or if necessary, you can do it by a manned pilot using the same vehicle. Optionally piloted vehicles. This weekend at Langley, in the Heritage flight, I saw an F-4 Phantom. That F-4 Phantom's day job is it's a remotely piloted vehicle. It's
really?
Actually an optionally piloted vehicle. They fly it with a pilot during the air shows, but really it's designed to be shot down. I mean, it's been converted to a full drone, and it can fly NOLO, otherwise known as no live operator. So it's not really a new concept. Any drone that we've had for the last 30 years, the F-100s, F-102s, F-106s, Phantoms, and soon to be F-16s, they've all been optionally piloted vehicles. Either the pilot can fly it or it can fly NOLO or no live operator. So we're not really stretching the bounds of the imagination here.
I guess I can see where you have an existing airplane and, you know, you convert it in that way to use it as a drone. But I guess the thought that struck me with this Firebird is that, you know, if you're designing a new aircraft that can do either, that it seems kind of inefficient. I mean, in order to allow for the capability of flying either manned or unmanned, I don't know. It just seems like that's kind of inefficient, and it would be sort of a costly thing to produce as compared to something that was specifically designed to be unmanned.
Well, it depends upon the mission. Do you want eyes in the cockpit making the decision, or do you want someone making the decision thousands of miles away? I mean, pilots aren't going to go away, despite the fact that I witnessed an SR-22 this weekend that they fly unmanned just because Rob's getting really old and they need somebody to fly an SR-22.
Yeah.
the option of having an aircraft where you could either fly it manned or fly it unmanned, it depends upon the severity of the mission, too. I mean, if you're going to fly in combat and the mission is too severe, then you can take the pilot out. Likewise, if you're flying in civilian airspace and you don't really want to be tooling around with the aircraft, like, for example, let's say you need to move the aircraft from Florida to Edwards Air Force Base, and it's a drone. Do you really want a drone flying over in that civilian airspace, or do you want a human aboard?
Yeah.
I mean, there's various options why you would do it.
Okay. All right. Thanks, David. All right. For our last story, this comes from Reuters. Number of ILFC Tardy customers doubled in first quarter. Now, ILFC, International Lease Finance Corporation, is one of the largest leasing companies in the industry. If I recall correctly, they have something on the order of 900 aircraft that they lease. This article states that the number of customers at least 2 months behind in lease payments is now at the highest level since the end of the third quarter of 2009, and the amount that are late has more than tripled since the end of 2010. And I would think that these customers of ILFC would mostly be airlines, maybe exclusively. I'm not certain. But I don't know. Does this what does this say about the state of the industry? Anything?
So, yeah, this is certainly very interesting. According to the SEC filing that Reuters is referencing, there are 77 aircraft that are 2 or more months behind from 17 different ILFC customers. And that represents about $36.2 million in late lease payments. So just to provide a little bit of context there, it's 77 aircraft. But as Max said, ILFC has over 930 aircraft. So it is a small portion of the fleet. It's about a little bit over 8%. So just to provide some context there. But I mean, it's certainly interesting to see a very large increase from the end of 2010, as the article notes. So in 2010, there were 22 aircraft late from 8 customers, and that only represented $11.1 million in late lease payments. So it's a very interesting increase. So we'll have to see, of course, how ILFC manages it. I mean, this is, part of finance in any industry,
right,
is risk management. It's been figuring out, okay, how much, you know, obviously you're going to assume, you know, that some of your customers, whether it be an aircraft lease or a home mortgage, aren't going to be able to pay on time, and you have to manage that risk. So it'll be interesting to see how this develops. And since also, just to provide some a little bit more context, the third quarter of 2009 that the article referenced, in that case, there were 69 aircraft late, so a little bit less than now, from 18 customers, which is one more than right now. But those 69 aircraft represented $46.3 million in revenue, so a little bit more revenue. And of course, you know, ILFC doesn't break down the numbers down. You'd assume that depending on the aircraft, you know, you're going to have different lease rates for different aircraft types, and they don't really provide any information, at least from what I can find, on the fleet mix that's the exact mix of those aircraft.
Sure.
So. But just to provide a little bit more information, so right now, $36.2 million in lease payments that are behind by 2 or more months. But in the first quarter, ILFC, their total revenue, to provide some insight there, is it was $1.17-ish billion. So it's a portion of the fleet. Obviously, ILFC, they always have to manage this risk, and it'll be interesting to see how the situation develops further. But yeah, I mean, for the number of aircraft late and the amount of lease payments behind to both of those to more than triple in a quarter is certainly an interesting little stat.
I thought the last sentence in the article was quite interesting. This reads, Stephen Udvar-Hazy, the founder of the business that is formerly known as International Lease Finance Corporation, has said he would like to buy ILFC via his new leasing business, Air Lease Corporation. Wow. I'm not sure what's behind that. Stephen Udvar-Hazy, of course, used to be ILFC and then left that company not too long ago and formed another leasing company, as this mentions, Air Lease Corp. But I don't know what he's got in mind in terms of buying ILFC back. I don't know how that would even be possible, but I don't know.
Lots of money.
Quite a lot.
Well, the other interesting thing that's mixed in with all this is the fact that ILFC is part of AIG and that mess.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Udvar-Hazy, Of course, we have the Udvar-Hazy Center, which is a part of the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum. The Udvar-Hazy Center is the portion at Dulles. And there's an event coming up there next month, June 18th, actually.
What's that, Max?
Well, they're having...
Dulles going to freeze over.
No. No, that comes right after.
That's after that. It's become a pilot day. And this
it's become a pilot day when it used to be something else?
I don't know. It's a special day. There's a special event there's a fly-in. There's a lot of activities for airplane geeks, certainly, but also families and so forth. One of the interesting things is we have our friends Milford and Charlie from Flight Time Radio, who last year produced their radio program live from the event last year, and they're going to be doing it again this year.
Well, that's nice.
But there's kind of a twist. They're invited some other aviation podcasters to participate in this live broadcast, which will then subsequently be recorded and issued as a podcast.
Wait, who's going to be there?
Other podcasters? Who could they be?
I was planning on being there. Any of you guys?
You mean go to Washington?
Yeah, to Washington, to Dulles for this June 18th.
June 18th?
Rob, are you going to be there?
Gee, I don't know. I'll go. Will you go, Max?
I'll definitely go. How about you, Dan?
I plan on being there, but I will not be speaking to Rob.
And David. David, are you going to come as well?
The car's all packed up and ready to go. You know me. I'll put hundreds of miles on it. For an air show.
Well, fantastic. So we're going to have the entire crew there. That'll be very exciting for a couple of different reasons, I'm sure.
And what would those be?
well, one of which is we've never met each other, or at least not all of us.
You know, I think that's really funny. I'll bet a lot of people that listen to the show don't realize we have not all ever been in the same place at the same time.
That's right.
That's my hell freezing over comment.
Yeah,
exactly. So I think this is going to be really cool. So let's see. So that's June 18th,
right,
of 2011.
That's right.
And what time does the show start?
10 a.m. I think
we go on at 10 o'clock or something.
We go on at 10. You can find. In fact, the event starts at 10. It runs from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. There's a website. I'll put it in the show notes, but it's www.nasm.si.edu/becomeapilot. So you can visit that website and you can see all of the events. There's going to be aircraft on display. There'll be activities. I think they're going to have some simulators.
Aircraft on display at the National Air and Space Museum. What a novel concept.
Well, I think there's actually going to be additional aircraft that are going to be flying
in. Actually, I've been down there on that day.
You have.
And what most people don't realize is the National Air and Space Museum actually has a taxiway out to Dulles that's got a fenced taxiway. And I, dumb luck, walked into this event 2 years ago. And on the flight line were an EC-135, a KC-135, five F-16s, an F-15, a whole bunch of civilian GA aircraft like SR-22s and Cessnas. And ultralights, a hot air balloon, and helicopters. Wow. So not only do you get all the museum stuff, you get a huge collection of aircraft that have just flown in for the day. It's pretty awesome.
This is going to be great. Now, our listeners can actually help out. The folks at Flight Time Radio, Milford and Charlie, they have a one-hour program, but they're looking to buy an additional hour, a second hour, to lengthen the show that would include us and some others. Rob, you want to tell folks how they might be able to help us out with this?
Well, sure. And if you remember back to the last presidential election, one of the great successes, not necessarily as to whether that president was elected or not. So remember, we don't do politics here, even though I've tried sometimes, but I've been squashed relentlessly. But remember that one of the things that worked very well for the Obama campaign were people donating $5, $10 here and there, and it didn't really cost anybody a whole lot of money. But everybody working together was able to bring about a change that they really wanted. And so that's kind of what we're hoping, is that by the time the show goes up on the by the time you're hearing this, there should be a link up on the Airplane Geeks website that will tell you how to go about dropping $5 in the kitty if you believe in our show this one particular time, so you can help us buy that extra hour at Dulles on June 18th and become a geek. And of course, what we will do for you if you donate $5 or $10 of your hard-earned money to the Airplane Geek Second Hour with the Flight Time Radio guys is that we'll get you one of our new Airplane Geeks buttons,
all right,
which will be on display at the Udvar-Hazy Pavilion. And also, I think we'll mention their names. Don't you guys think we should mention the names of the people that were nice enough to donate? I think we should.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So get your name on the radio, get an Airplane Geeks button, and oh my God, what else could we... I mean, is there anything else that would be worth it other than that? I think that would be enough, don't you guys?
Well, that plus showing up.
Well yeah, and saying thank you, obviously.
Yeah. Anyone in the D.C. area, Northern Virginia, Baltimore, Maryland area, this is a great event.
Out.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the historian will be there. Maybe we can arrange a guided tour of the museum.
Oh, very
and we'll
nice,
be autographing.
David.
We'll be autographing Dan Webb, and you can have a picture of an autographed Dan Webb.
You're talking about autographing, writing on Dan?
Well, yeah, we were going to do a picture, but that's very labor intensive because then you have to keep signing them all. So we just figured we'd autograph Dan and then take a picture of him. What do you think, Dan?
Yay.
He's enthusiastic.
So watch when you get through listening to the show tonight. Go up and look on the Airplane Geeks website. David, I'm sure we can put something up on Facebook as well.
Yep.
That will just be a little link, and it'll tell you how to do it. It's real easy. We're going to do it through PayPal, and if you don't have a PayPal account, it's real easy to set one up, and it's real safe. And the most that's going to happen is we'd clean out your bank account. Well, we probably wouldn't. Oh, we weren't supposed to tell them that, were we?
Again, our guest this episode is Todd McClamark from My Flight Blog. Todd, welcome again to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm really enjoying myself and seeing kind of behind the curtain and how the show's made. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's not what you'd think, is it?
No, but I know there's been some talk about you guys putting out a unedited show, and it would be entertaining. It's been fun.
It would. We may have to do that someday.
I'm glad you're not doing it for my episode.
That's right. That's right. Now, I know that you've one of the things that you've been interested in is sort of the decline of the general aviation population. And I think maybe you've written about this lately, particularly AOPA's got a flight training retention initiative. Maybe you can kind of tell us something about that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when you say I'm interested, I'm definitely following it, but not excited about it. It's one of the great challenges we've got out there that the pilot population continues to decline. And AOPA has come out with a recent study that kind of is trying to really define what the cause of the dropout rate is. You know, anybody that's in business kind of knows that you build a funnel and you measure your success down the funnel. And there's a great success in getting people to the flight schools. There's a lot of people that come out and want to learn to fly. The problem really happens between their first visit to that flight school and when they should be earning their license. And there's a significant dropout. As much as 80% of those people that come out to learn to fly don't make it through earning their pilot certificate. And I think 50 or 60% of those don't even get to the student pilot certificate. And so they're starting to really put a lot of attention around that and to figure out how we can help people stay with it and earn their pilot's license, which will help invigorate the whole industry if we can continue to rebuild that pilot population. And so I'm very excited to see that some time is being put towards it. I know that they've identified that some of the areas of challenges is really around the aviation community, which is is a little bit surprising because I think we all love this community and the tight knit group of people that love aviation.
Right.
But I do kind of understand where that comes from. I think there's a reason that a podcast like yours is so successful. You know, people need to look to online media and to podcasts to kind of find like-minded people. In your day-to-day in the office, you might not find someone that really wants to talk about flying for hours at end and may not be as passionate about hearing about your last lesson where you were doing stalls and things like that. And so, yeah, I think more needs to be done to help students find other students and to keep them engaged and give them people to talk to as a sounding board as they're going through the process so they don't just walk away from flying, that they find companions and the camaraderie to keep them involved.
Yeah, this is kind of interesting. So, I mean, you're saying that one of the reasons for the high dropout rate is that people start to get their training, but just don't kind of find a sense of community, don't find others to relate to?
Yeah, definitely. That was one of the areas that showed the weakest ratings for when they asked people, you know, what were their expectations for learning to fly and what was the reality of going through the process. And a lot of people kind of mentioned that there was less of a community than they expected. They were getting less recognition and they were looking for some sort of recognition and less kind of support. And, you know, from the people I've talked to that go through learning to fly and that experience, they all go through a period where they're very excited about what they're doing and they want to consume as much information as possible. But at times, you know, maybe their instructor isn't as excited about it. They've had 30 different students and, you know, talking about stalls or something that's exciting to a brand new pilot might not be as exciting for a CFI at the time. And so, you know, helping them find other people that are going through the same experiences and having them have, you know, mentors or people to engage with about that experience would be much more valuable, I think, and help a lot.
How could we do that? How could we connect people learning to fly with others who are enthusiastic about it?
You know, I think there's a lot of great resources out there. I think a lot of it's kind of building awareness. You know, I think in the blogosphere, there's a lot of people that are writing about it. And, you know, in tools like Twitter, you know, it's great that, you know, when I was learning to fly, Twitter wasn't around. But now, you know, if you're having troubles with a G1000 glass cockpit, you can chat literally with the person that wrote the book on how to use the G1000, Max Trescott. He's out there on Twitter. And so, you know, there's great resources for pilots now to kind of reach out and find some of these people. I think it's a matter of flight schools making their students aware, giving them, you know, lists of resources, you know, check out these blogs, these forums. And then also, you know, outside of being online, hosting events to get students together. I know when I was learning to fly, I barely ever saw other students. They kind of kept us in our own little silos, whereas it would have been great if they did more events to kind of bring us together and give us a chance to learn from each other.
Huh.
If I can add something to what Todd is saying, as I mentioned earlier, Todd and I are in the same flying club over in Chicago at Chicago Executive Airport, just north of O'Hare. And one of the things that we tried to do when the club was formed was to look at all the elements of why people learn to fly and why they stop. And we had heard this from a lot of people that they didn't seem to be as engaged in the whole process. And so when the club was formed, it was built around the idea that we would have events. We have a breakfast every month. Where people can get together, and it's for any club member, whether you're an instructor or a student, and so we have those people that do get together, and everybody, you know, it's a big 2 hours of schmoozing and telling lies and experiences, and you know, it's an awful. I think it's a lot of fun. We've had you know, and I think Todd, you were at another organization on the same airport, And I think we were talking, and some of the things that you talked about were exactly what we wanted to try to bring to the club. I realize it's never perfect. I mean, sometimes it doesn't always come together the way we'd like, but it's the goal. It's everybody's goal to try to be friends with everybody, at least meet them, say hi to everybody. We've got our own little clubhouse there at the airport, and you know, it by and large, I think it's worked fairly well.
Yeah, no, I can't agree with you more, Rob. It's something where, you know, I'm a a private pilot that just recently had twin children, and it's very easy for a person in my situation to kind of walk away from aviation. There could be, you know, more demands on my time, and you know, aviation is expensive and things like that. And at Windy City, a club that I was with that really didn't focus on the social aspect, I might have slowly walked away from aviation. I doubt that would have happened, but it's possible. Whereas since I've joined Leading Edge, I've been much more active. I've been out to the airport a lot more than I had been in the previous year. You know, I'm finding people that I can share the cockpit with to bring down the cost of flying. So, you know, that community and that move for me has been a very beneficial move and really helped reinvigorate my flying.
Now, how about people starting down this path? I mean, we've been talking about folks who do start and then fall away. What are we seeing in terms of people getting started? Are the numbers okay there, or is that declining as well?
You know, I don't have the numbers there. I don't know, Rob, if you've got a better sense there. I know that the pilot starts hasn't been as big of an issue. I'm sure it's probably down a little bit with the economy the way it is, but I think the results of all the studies that people put together is that the number of people starting still doesn't seem to be too bit bad of a challenge. If we can get, you know, even 40 or 50% of those people to continue flying, then it would solve a lot of the problems. So I think, you know, a lot of the problem is either certified pilots walking away from aviation or the aging population kind of slowing down in their flying is probably a bigger challenge.
Yeah, and it is it really is a problem, again, in the finishing side. And part of that really comes down to the instructors as well. You know, I've been harping on this for years, but there are people that happen to be pilots that are willing to show other people how to be pilots. And that's not quite the same thing as someone like a Max Truscott that we all know and love and who we're supposed to be booking on our show here down the road. So in case you hear that, Max, we're working on it, buddy. But, you know, people that are actually educators and realize that there's a great deal of human behavior that you really need to take into account in order to produce a successful student. And unfortunately, sometimes that's not the way instructors look at it. They look at it as one more hour in their logbook, not necessarily, is Todd going to get his license or not? And you know, to Todd, that's extremely important, and it should be just as important to the instructor. But that's not always the case, unfortunately.
Yeah, Rob, I think you know that instructor effectiveness is definitely kind of one of the issues. I know I've got a neighbor that's luckily back into aviation. He had started to learn to fly almost 15 years ago, but his instructor was probably pushing him a little bit too hard, and probably. Didn't have enough background in education and able to see that, you know, she was straining him a bit. And he just kind of walked away from aviation. And just recently, he and I have been talking and he's decided to go back and seek his license. And he just finished his first solo a few weeks ago. And so, you know, I think what I always tell students when I get a chance to talk to them is make sure that, you know, you try another instructor every once in a while or try a different flight school before you walk away because, you know, not all of these people are trained to be educators. You know, a lot of them are very good at what they do. But if you don't find someone that's good, try someone else before you walk away.
Yeah, good point.
Maybe shifting a little, Todd, in an email that we traded previously, you mentioned that you took the course, the Art of Aeronautical Decision Making, as part of the FAA Wings program. What's the FAA Wings program? What's that all about?
You know, it's a great program that they run that provides educational materials to kind of keep you current in your knowledge and goes towards accreditation. So you know, you can skip a annual flight review or biannual flight review if you take some of these courses, and they're a combination of online kind of training courses, but then also things that you can do with an instructor in the airplane. And there's some really great material out there that uses in-cockpit video or audio from actual experiences that pilots have gone through. And so I found those resources to be very beneficial.
And so what is the Art of Aeronautical Decision Making?
The Art of Aeronautical Decision Making is really about being wise in the plane and not flying by the seat of your pants. You know, the majority of accidents that take place are pilot error, and a lot of that can be solved through good decision making, and that's preparation, It's perceiving issues in air and then making an appropriate decision that's going to result in a safe outcome.
Okay. You know, having a blog is kind of interesting in that, you know, as you experience different things, you get to, you know, try to share those things with, you know, with your readers, with your audience. And you've done a lot of interesting things, I think. Is there one or two that sort of stands out in your mind, some experiences that you just really loved having and loved relating to your readers?
Yeah, no, well, one of the best benefits that have come out of blogging is just meeting so many different people and being able to inspire some people and being inspired by others that will write in and give advice when I was going through training and needed a pick-me-up after a bad lesson or something like that. So there were a lot of benefits there. But then also, over the years, I've had the opportunity to go out and meet a lot of really neat pilots, a lot of the people on the air show circuit. And that's been really neat. I've had the chance to fly with Sean Tucker and seen his performances up close. Gotten a chance to, for the last 3 or 4 years, I've been going to the Chicago Air and Water Show, which is one of the largest air shows in the country. And getting to go to their media day and meet all the pilots and do some flying with them, which has been an absolute hoot. Most recently, I had the opportunity to go out. There's a flight club here on the suburbs of Chicago and Aurora called Gauntlet Warbirds. And Greg Morris, the chief pilot out there, had me out and took me up to fly in their L-39, which I know Steve Vischer down in the Australia Report. Yes. Had a chance to fly in that recently as well, and just an absolutely amazing aircraft for a guy who's normally, you know, flying around at 100 knots in a Cessna or a Diamond. To get up in a jet and get a chance to take the controls was a great experience, a lot of fun.
Did you get sick?
You know, I didn't. I was nervous. I'd never gotten sick before, and nor passed out doing aerobatics before. But Greg did inform me that in the jet, rather than in an extra 300 or something like that, that, you know, the duration of those G forces was going to be much longer and potentially give me a chance to black out. And I did come close. I was thinking through the process of he kept saying, if you feel like you're seeing tunnel vision, tell me to knock it off. And I started to see tunnel vision. I kept saying, what was I supposed to say? What was I supposed to say? And then luckily the maneuver stopped and I made it through.
Now, you've also flown in the B-17, I think. Is that right?
Yeah.
What was that like? Man, I think that would be just fantastic.
Yeah, really neat experience. And it was made all that much better because the day I flew with it, there was a gentleman that was there with his grandchildren, and he had flown the B-17 in the war.
Wow.
And had not been in or around one since then. And he was going up with us and was just sharing some of his stories. And it was really neat to hear him talk about the plane and to see both the pride that he had in his eyes, but also kind of the sadness as he told some of those stories. But an amazing aircraft. When those radial engines kick in, it gave me goosebumps, and had the opportunity to fly it up from Valparaiso, Indiana, up to Chicago. So got a good 45 minutes in the plane, and just an absolutely neat plane. I was like a kid just running around checking out all the different vantage points. Beautiful plane.
Is that incredibly noisy and drafty? And
yeah, it's all that you would expect. I can understand why they needed those thick leather jackets. We were flying at maybe 2,000-3,000 feet coming along the lakeshore, and it was chilly, breezy, and definitely very loud.
That's very cool. Well, your site is at myflightblog.com. Todd, you're also on Twitter, I think.
Yep, also myflightblog on Twitter.
Great. Anything coming up with the blog that is interesting that you could you know, clue us in on?
Well, next week, or I believe it's May 25th, Virgin America will be starting service out of Chicago. So I'm going to go out and participate in their unveiling ceremony at the gates at O'Hare. And Sir Richard Branson will be there. So looking forward to getting a chance to meet him, hopefully. And then also just, you know, continuing to write about flying experiences throughout the summer. And then in August, I typically spend about a week covering the Chicago Air and Water Show. So always looking forward to that.
You know, and I actually, I'm curious, Todd, when you've been writing My Flight Blog for how many years now?
Started it in 2004, yeah.
So can you imagine a time when you won't write it?
You know, it's become kind of one of those things that, yeah, I don't see a time when that happens. I enjoy, after coming back from a flight, writing about it. I think definitely when I was learning to fly, it was very kind of almost therapeutic. It helped me kind of rehash everything I had just learned. And so I find it's a good way to kind of do a formal debrief after every flight, to just kind of come back and look at some of the photos or video I might have taken and think about some of the challenges I might have gone through and share it with the friends that I've made through the blog. So yeah, I don't see any time soon that I would be stopping doing that.
I hope so. And for people that are thinking about learning to fly, that's really the best part of my flight blog, is that if you don't walk away after reading some of Todd's stuff feeling like, wow, either I understand what goes on now, or man, have I been in the same place, you're probably missing something. And that's what it's all about, is to get people to understand that we've all been through those challenges, and it's all about hanging in there and finishing.
Yeah, it's the community.
Yeah, it is, really.
All right. Well, we really appreciate you coming on the show, Todd. And of course, that's myflightblog.com. Look for that. Even if you're not a pilot or a prospective pilot, I think blogs like this are extremely interesting. You learn a lot about aviation. And, you know, even if you're not going to, you know, go that route yourself, it's definitely worth it and very interesting. Todd, your blog is very good. Any advice for folks who are either thinking about or are actually writing their own aviation blogs, you know, as an accomplished blogger, can you offer some wisdom?
I don't know about wisdom, but I encourage them to do it. I think it's great. I know that when I started doing this, there were very few blogs out there dedicated to general aviation, and the blog role that I keep on the side of my blog has continued to grow. I know, Max, on your site, I'm sure that the listings for blogs continues to grow. And
oh, yeah.
That's a great thing. I mean, everyone has their own style and things that they like to learn about. And so, people will find someone that's of interest to them. I know I like to follow several bloggers that fly out of airports that I used to fly out of. It makes their tales a little bit more relevant to me. And so I encourage everyone to give it a try.
Fantastic. Okay. Thanks again, Todd.
Thanks so much, guys.
This episode, we're going to forego David's This Week in Aviation segment because he's got an interesting interview that he conducted at Langley Air Show. David, do you want to set this up?
Well, we've had a request, and I forget the listener, hopefully, wanted to know how the F-35 lift fan worked. Well, Max and I have struggled with trying to figure out how we were going to present this because, in all honesty, I know how a Harrier works, but don't have a clue how the lift fan works. Well, I went to, if you're going to go and there's a Lockheed Martin tent with an F-35 representative at that tent, it seems to me it's kind of the important, you might as well stick a microphone in and ask him how the lift fan works. Thus, we have the interview. Hopefully this answers the question for those people out there who wanted to know how it works. Roll tape, Max.
This is David Vanderhoof from the Airplane Geeks. I'm at the Lockheed Martin tent here at Langley Air Force Base. I'm here with Billy Deal. We're going to do a little talking about one of the questions that keeps popping up on the show, the lift fan of the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter Lightning II B or Bravo model. Billy, first, would you like to give me your title?
Okay, I'm Billy Deal. I'm the customer engagement person for the Air Force's variant of the F-35. You know, we build three variants, but I'm familiar with the B model, so I can answer your questions on the way it does its vertical landing and a short takeoff.
Okay, Billy, first let's use your expertise and let's talk about the Alpha model, or the one that may possibly end up on this base or a lot of other bases across the United States and worldwide.
Okay, the Alpha model, that's mainly for our Air Force and seven of our eight partners. It's called a conventional takeoff and landing model. Basically, all three variants operate the same as soon as you get the gear up. Avionics-wide, they're 99% identical. They just all land and take off differently. The CTOL, the A model, lands conventionally, conventional takeoff and landing. So that's the big difference in the Air Force's model. Now, the B model for our Marine Corps and Italy and other countries that would like to be able to work off an extremely small strip, like a 1,200-foot runway, and actually can take off vertically for an air show. You'll see it doing that a lot, but not with a full load of ordnance. It takes about 550 feet to take off the full load of ordnance and weapons internally. The carrier variant is a much bigger airplane, much more control surfaces with the wingtips folding up and all, so it can land slower on the carrier deck. And it's a much heavier structure because the carrier landing is pretty violent maneuver on the structure. Those are the big differences in the aircraft. But once they're airborne, they fly basically the same as far as avionics.
Okay, well, let's get to the nitty-gritty. Let's talk about the B model and its approaching the field. And I'm an expert, or quote, the expert on military aviation, and I know how a Harrier thrust vectoring works, but I don't know how that lift fan interacts with that jet engine. Can you give me some more details?
I can. Well, you know, on the Harrier, it's all directed thrust by nozzles and all. Very complicated system. And we learned that, you know, what we needed to build in the STOVL, short takeoff and vertical landing, is we wanted a fan. So Rolls-Royce builds this 50-inch counter-rotating lift fan that goes right behind the pilot. And that controls the lift from beneath the forward part of the aircraft. Then the nozzle, we have a three-bearing nozzle that will rotates down that controls the aft. Both of them will produce about 3,000 pounds of thrust. And now we have roll posts on each wing to control the roll of the aircraft. And they will produce about 1,500 pounds each. So you get a lot of thrust out of that engine. The way we drive the lift fan, the drive shaft that goes to a clutch mechanism that converts that horsepower by the engine, which is 28,000 horsepower, to drive the lift fan. The beauty of the lift fan, it's not direct thrust, and it's a cool air. Which, you know, in the Harrier, we have a problem with hot gas ingestion. We have to worry about that a little bit, but not nearly what the Harrier did. And of course, it's much easier to work around when you're landing with a fan rather than. And it's working extremely well. We were very excited about it. Initially, some people may have read that we're having trouble with the STOVL. Well, we were, but nothing with the big components that I just mentioned. It was all with the mechanization of the hinges on the doors. Since then, February, March, last month, and this month, it's leading the pack on a flight test and flight test points. So it's doing extremely well in flight tests. And we're very proud of how it's all coming together. It has 9 doors that open up to have the lift fan open and an aux air door open up, and plus all the other doors that need to open for the bottom for the lift fan to exhaust and all. So it's doing extremely well. We're very proud of how well the STOVL is doing.
And once you transition to the forward flight,
yes,
the engine nozzle in the back rotates forward, what happens to the lift fan? Does it just shut down, or how does that work?
Well, you got to realize this airplane has 8.5 million lines of code it's working with, so it's very much computerized, and it realizes how fast the pilot is going. He may ask it to convert to up and away flight, i.e., do we track the lift fan and start going forward? And as long as the airspeed is there for it, it'll slowly retract the nozzle and the lift fan, and it'll slowly convert. But it won't let you, the pilot can push it. If he's not going fast enough, air over the wings, it won't let him. But it's, again, very well mechanized. As hard as the Harrier is to fly, I mean, it really takes a lot of talent to fly the Harrier. It's pretty manual and intense for the pilot for takeoff and landing. Where anybody at this flight show with about 5 minutes of instructions will be able to take off, land, hover in the STOVL. without any assistance. And it's a very simple airplane to fly, believe it or not. And in the all, we have about 15 or maybe 17, 16 or 17 test pilots, and they all say the same thing. The cockpit demonstrator that we take around the country and the simulators we have at Fort Worth, everybody says, this is way too easy. They know. Test pilots say, no. As a matter of fact, coming down, it will not let you land too hard. It actually flares for the pilot, and it cancels what they call a suck-down effect when you get closer. So it's a very easy airplane to fly, and flight test is proving out that it's doing well. It's way ahead of its test points right now. So we're real excited about how she's going to do in flight test.
Well, Billy, I appreciate you taking the time. It's been a big question, and we have jet engine experts, but it's been always one of those, okay, I don't know how this works, but I'll find out, and I really appreciate you taking the time, and thank you for being on Airplane Geeks.
Great to be here. Great to talk about the new F-35.
Well, thanks, David, for that.
Yeah, nice job on that.
Your roving reporter. Got the question, we'll go get the answer.
Fantastic. Now, you have some other interviews that you did at the at Langley that you're going to make available later on, I think?
Absolutely, yep. But I figured this was a high priority one because we've been working on, you and I, Max, have been working on this for a while now. So
yep.
Hopefully that satisfies the answers. If it doesn't, we'll keep digging.
Very good.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, May 14th, 2011. Hey, welcome to the Ozdesk, folks. It's Grant and Grant only here. I've got rid of that Vischer guy. Steve, I've flown an L-39. I'm a jet pilot. Vischer, he's gone. It's just me, but I've brought in someone special.
It's time for the Oz Desk. I'm Stephen Force.
Hey, Mr. Force, how you going?
I'm doing well. How about you, man?
Yeah, not too bad, mate. Not too foul at all. And look, I've brought you in because I figure, hey, we've got to keep the Steve balance. And, you know, you were online at the time, so let's get on with it. Quick run through, mate. Let's look at Virgin. Did you know that Delta V has got US approval?
Is that a jet team?
No, that's the alliance between Delta and Virgin Australia.
What's a Virgin?
Right, moving on. Okay, how about Virgin Australia getting rid of their E-170s and giving them to Delta?
Do they fly upside down?
Oh, I think the passengers hope not. Okay, this is getting interesting. What about Qantas? Qantas are going up against the unions again. The pilots possibly going on strike. The engineers decided to cancel their strike due to, quote, technical difficulties in the Qantas aircraft. They've had a few engine problems lately.
Surely it's the smoke systems that they're having the issues with, right?
Well, they were putting out a lot of smoke when the engines caught on fire. Okay. Okay. What about, here's another one. Oh, this is military. New Zealand Air Force. They had a celebration with 6th Squadron doing a flyby with a Catalina and also in formation with a pair of Sea Sprites. How cool is that?
What's a Sea Sprite? Is that supposed to be something to intimidate people?
Could be. I know in Australia it intimidated a lot of people when they tried to make their own versions of it and it didn't work. But hey, do you know what? Australia's just done its first deployment of Super Hornets. We've just recently got some Super Hornets, and we've just deployed the Rhino overseas in Exercise Bersama Shield out of Butterworth in Malaysia.
That's outstanding. Yeah, we love those. We land those on boats.
Yeah, you guys are mad. You put them on a postage stamp in the heaving ocean in the middle of the night, don't you?
Pitching deck, man, pitching deck. And it's our centennial of naval aviation, man. Could not be prouder over here.
Well, yeah, no, we're loving the Hornets. They're all new. I mean,
Sorry. Oh, g'day, mate. Sorry, I'm late. I didn't realize you'd started without me. Am I late for something? Or how are you?
How'd you get in?
Oh, you're Who's here that? In the studio. And hey, look. Hey, Steve Tupper's on Skype. How are you, mate?
Steve Vischer, doing well, man. How about you?
Oh, fellow jet jockey. Hey, did you want to talk about jets?
Oh, hey.
Of course. Oh, I thought I sensed a slight whiff of JP-8 coming out of the computer. That would explain it.
Oh,
good
yes.
Good to hear you, man.
Yeah. Well, nice. You know, I'm finally a little bit taller now after those G-forces compressed me a little bit.
But... Well, speaking of Gs, I pulled 8 Gs sustained. Don't you forget that, mate.
Yeah, no, forget about that, prop boy. So, Tup, when are you going up with the Blue Angels? Have you got that planned on the schedule yet?
What? I'm working. I was just up in Fat Albert, but, man, I'm working toward the Hornet. I mean, any model is fine, but pushing for the Super Hornet if I can possibly get there.
Come on, guys. I've pulled 8G, okay? I'm the one who pulled 8G. So, yeah, you may have been in jets, but I've pulled 8Gs.
How far out of a balloon do you have to fall to sustain the 8Gs?
Oh, hey, I think this Steve's worse than the other Steve.
No, I'm quite enjoying this. In fact, I think we should get rid of Grant at some point and just make it two Steves. What do you think, mate?
Yeah, it would make it easy to refer to us. And, you know, frankly, a little bit more JP8 can't hurt anybody.
Absolutely.
Oh, what are you going to do? Call it the Steve desk or something?
I think Jet Jockey's Corner would be better. What do you think about that, Steve?
We just stay with the Steve thing, but we need to rename Grant.
Well, I don't know. We couldn't call him Prop Boy. That'd be so pretentious. Hey.
Prop Boy Steve.
Oh, guys, come on. I'm still here. I'm right here. Hello.
Well, you stormed out of the studio last week, Grant. I thought that was very rude. I mean, I'm the one who's Dutch here. I'm supposed to be the rude one.
Yeah, but you were rubbing my nose in this whole jet thing, and I'm still naffed about that. I mean, all I've got going for me is 8 Gs. That's it, man. I sustained 8 Gs. You haven't beaten that yet.
8 Gs. You know, 8 Gs is okay, but when you sustain 9, I mean, you know, that's when you really get the pull. I mean, that's when you weigh more than some airplanes. I mean, 9 Gs. 9 Gs is the proper amount of pull. I mean, that's right. when the airplane will push the stick.
I think I've had enough here. Thank you very much. You've just trumped me once again. Whose idea was it to bring Tupper on, huh? That's right.
I think it was yours.
Something I said.
Yeah, it was something you guys said. That's it. I'm out of here.
Well, let's get rid of him, Steve.
Touchy, isn't he?
He is touchy. Well, you know, speaking of prop-driven aircraft, you know, our display team here for the Royal Australian Air Force, they fly PC-9s. I don't know what the equivalent of that would be over in the US, but have you had any experience in aircraft similar to that?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, the T-6A Texan II, the new primary trainer for the Air Force and increasingly the Navy, is essentially, I believe it's a PC-9 on steroids. It's basically the airplane, then almost half again the cost for a couple of Martin Baker ejection seats.
And now, Steve, in all seriousness, you're the most prolific aviation podcaster around, particularly when it comes to this sort of stuff. I mean, how does one manage to get so many jet rides and so many rides with the military?
It is a matter of massively parallel begging and also heading to stuff like ICAST and being, you know, going to the air shows. You know, I'm here in Indianapolis today. It's going to rain today. I don't know that anybody who needs more than a couple of thousand feet of ceiling is going to be able to fly. But the point is, you go, you hang out in the ramp, you talk to people because you genuinely care about them. The last thing is I write the best proposal for a meteor ride of any sentient species known. You just, you know, you do your homework, you identify the value proposition for the jet team, because, you know, it's got to work for them too. It's got to get their message out, and it's a message that I believe in, and that's a big part of it.
It's all about promoting the military in the most positive light, isn't it? Particularly in this new media sphere, this is where we really have the advantage.
Well, the Air Force came out in, I believe, May of 2009, and the Navy followed up. Both have, you know, official top level doctrine about engagement with new media and social media. That's a place where folks like you, folks like me, can help them check that box while at the same time really tapping into the fanboy energy that frankly benefits both of us.
Well, Stephen, actually, it was very kind of you to forward a copy of that proposal over here. Look, Grant, I've got it here. Come back into the studio, Grant.
Look, he's really scowling through that window.
Grant, we'll send this off to the roulettes, I promise. I'll put your name at the top.
Guys, that's a problem. The logo for your show has both of you in it.
Oh, okay.
That's why it's not that I need to have my head embroidered on caps and shirts. It's just that I don't ever want there to be an argument about who gets the media ride.
Absolutely right.
Yeah, no, you can hold that in front of me and you can dangle that as a carrot. But, mate, if I'm not on the next meteor ride, you guys have had it.
Well, I tell you what, Grant, I might have trumped you, but just temporarily I've trumped Steve in getting an L-39 ride. But, Steve, that's not far away for you either, an L-39 ride.
I am sure hoping for it. The Hoppers usually perform at Battle Creek. Tim Brucci, who's been on the show, is there. And with any kind of luck, I will be successful in talking my way into the backseat of the slot ship for the Hoppers. But you beat me to the punch, man. I'm jealous. The L-39 is a gorgeous bird. I love them.
Yeah, and you know, the thing that surprises me about them is there's so many of them around in civilian use. Apparently there's some 300 or so in use in the U.S. alone.
They're not difficult to fly. They're reasonably inexpensive to maintain. Yeah, they drink a lot of gas, but as Tim said, he used to have a T-28 Trojan, and cost of ownership as between the Trojan and the L-39 with hot seats is roughly the same. You just burn more gas when you fly the L-39, but then again, you get to fly an L-39.
Well, Steve, Steve. It was very nice of you to come in and kick off this Ausdesk for us, a very unique one. And it was a bit cunning there of Grant to set it up before I even got in the studio, but we'll forgive him for that. If there's a rare off chance that anybody listening has not found your podcast, where can we find you online?
You bet. You can obviously subscribe to Airspeed through iTunes or the website with all the show notes is www.airspeedonline.com, all one word. And be sure to head over to acrocamp.com with upcoming announcements about the second installment of the movie series and me finally getting the first one edited.
Yeah, the movie that ate your podcast.
Yes, indeed. But, you know, I tell you what, it is. I can't let you throw me out of the broadcast booth without saying that I really appreciate the opportunity to come on your show. And, you know, we Americans, although we'll rarely admit it, are jealous of you because almost any flying you do from our perspective is inverted. And we think that's just class.
As we always say when we're on our flight time radio segment, Grant, we always fly inverted.
That's correct.
Absolutely. Well, that's about it for this very unique Ausdesk. Until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm the sulking Grant McCarran. I'm still sulking, man.
And I'm Stephen Force, Ground Point Niner.
Well, that was fun.
You know, that Steve Tupper guy's a wacky dude. I'll tell you, we catch up with him every year up at AirVenture, and he was making some kind of nectar of the gods last year.
Oh, is that right?
Party.
Sounds
and
good.
And I forgot what it was called, but it was liquid fire. So,
wow.
If you want to find out what that is, make sure you come to AirVenture this year.
Well, I'm glad you are really working at AirVenture and trying to cultivate new business.
Yes, right. Precisely, yes. That's a good point. Thank you,
Dan. And folks should be sure to check out airspeedonline.com if you haven't already. Steve produces a lot of interesting video. He's gotten really good at in-plane video. And there's lots of examples of some really fascinating stuff, some aerobatics and just all kinds of stuff that's really worth taking a look at. So thanks for the Australia Desk Report, including Steve Tupper, also known as Stephen Force. Okay, here's Peter Johnson across the pond.
Today, I'm joined by Diego Lopez Salazar. Diego has spent all of his life in and around aviation. His father worked for Iberia. Diego's wife worked for Singapore Airlines and now works for Lufthansa. Having worked with Spanair for some time, Diego is a co-founder and now general manager of MiraVuela.com, a Spanish search engine which delivers flight and holiday prices. Diego also presents a Spanish aviation podcast called Aero Podcast and claims to be a true airplane geek. Diego, welcome to Across the Pond.
Thank you, Peter. It's a great pleasure to meet you and to have the opportunity to share some minutes with the Airplane Geeks audience. As you just said, I'm passionate about aviation since I was a child, and I feel very lucky to be able to work on the travel sector.
Diego, can you tell us about Aero Podcast?
Well, every time I was in a dinner with some friends, I found that they were always interested in knowing things and details of the aviation world.
Yeah.
So a year ago, I thought that it could be interesting to find some way of sharing my knowledge and to be able to spend more time learning things about aviation. At the same time, I found the first podcast that talked about things that were happening on the Spanish tourism sector. And I thought that if they had an audience, it would be great to share with them a podcast where we could speak only about aviation.
Yeah.
And then I found that one of my best colleagues from Spanair, Marco Tawas, had a Mac computer and knew how to record and produce a podcast with some quality to record our first podcast. It was so fun to prepare the material and discuss about the latest news on the commercial aviation that until now we have recorded 14 chapters and we have quite a supporting audience with chapters with almost 1,000 downloads.
Wow.
The Aero Podcast has three segments. On the first segment, we discuss the latest news on domestic aviation in Spain. On the second segment, we discuss the latest news on aviation around the world. And the third segment is called Aero Tips and is dedicated to give some advice on traveling by plane, as, for example, what are the best seats on the plane, the best way to travel with children, etc. This last segment is done with Victoria Rodriguez, which is a very well-known travel blogger in Spain. On the chapters, we try to invite some friends that are involved with aviation to have their comments and share our thoughts with them. And we always have a really good time.
Yeah.
The podcast lasts around 45 minutes, and we try to have a new segment or a new subject every 5-8 minutes to make it easy to follow for the audience. The only problem we have right now is that we are recording one podcast a month due to a very busy agenda, but we would love to have a chapter every 2 weeks.
And how are Spanish airlines performing at the moment?
Well, the situation is changing very quickly. 6 years ago, we had Iberia, Spanair, and Air Europa serving all the domestic flights. And we also had some low-cost airlines that were flying from all Europe to the Spanish main tourist destinations. Today, the biggest airline on the Spanish airports is Ryanair, followed by Iberia, and then Vueling. Vueling is a low-cost airline that now has Iberia as shareholder. So Iberia found that the only way to fight against the power of low cost was to control one of them and use it as a feeder for their intercontinental flights.
Yeah.
At the same time, we have Air Europa that joined the SkyTeam and is a very solid airline, as the growth of the traffic and operation has been always quite conservative. They're flying within Spain, and also they're flying to some European destinations, but they do fly to Caribbean and South America. Quite busy airports for the Spanish market. And finally, we have Spanair that just comes from a change of owners. SAS had the control of the airline for several years and drove it to join the Star Alliance. But now they have local owners from Catalonia that are trying to make a growth of Barcelona Airport with more intercontinental connections, and they are going to try to use Spanair for make that growth of the airport. Well, I personally hate Ryanair for the quality of service they provide, and I feel very uncomfortable watching how they are growing on our domestic routes in Spain. And, well, they are playing a very nasty game, trying to force subsides from small airports where the politicians do not invest on getting the more loyal traffic to the destination rather than to the price of the airline.
We recently saw the merger between Iberia and British Airways. We hear a lot from BA, but how has this affected Iberia?
At this moment, we can't see big changes as both are operating codeshare flights.
Yeah.
And British Airways have been reducing their personnel in Spain on the last years, letting Iberia do the job in our country. Probably the first big change, it may be that they finally made the decision on buying new 330s for Iberia, as the 340s that they are flying today are getting a bit old.
Recently, we talked to Gian about the air traffic controllers and airport personnel going on strike. Has this been resolved now?
Hopefully, yes. The agreements have been signed with both the controllers and the rest of the airport personnel.
Excellent.
The cost of Spanish airports and traffic control were going too high, and the government decided to introduce big reforms. This year is going to be very interesting, as Madrid and Barcelona airports will be exploited by private companies, and as far as it develops, more airports will get partially private. We are now discussing and trying to understand how this new model will affect the airlines and the passengers, so I recommend you to keep an eye on it.
Thank you very much for sharing your views on Spanish aviation. Where can the listeners find you on the internet?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at the initial of my name, Diego, D. López Salazar. I spell DLOPEZSALAZAR. Or also at Mira y Vuela, also in Twitter. And all the information on my co-host, Marco Tawas, and me can also be found at our blog, which is aeropodcast.com, when you can listen to the podcast, of course in Spanish, that is also available on iTunes.
Diego, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Peter. And also thanks to Max, Rob, Dan, and David, and all the people that helps doing the Airplane Geek podcast, and also thank you for sharing all your knowledge with us, the people like me, the people listening to the Airplane Geek podcast every week. Bye-bye.
You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter and at alphatangopapa.blogspot.com. This is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
just because they're talking about banished low-cost carriers.
Uh-huh.
Moment of silence for ClickAir, which ceased operations a couple years ago, just because it's one of my favorite airline liveries ever.
Is that right?
Why is that?
I'm biased. One thing I really don't like about European airlines, actually, it's not just European anymore. I just don't really like Euro white liveries. So just, you know, boring white fuselage, maybe a cheat line and a logo. So ClickAir had this beautiful, it was a silver, I believe it, from pictures, it almost looks like it was a reflective paint with this beautiful blue design along the fuselage. And they merged with Voiling a couple years ago. But anyway.
Well, we want to thank Peter for having Diego on. That was pretty interesting. We have airplane geeks everywhere across the world, and glad to hear that Diego and his partner there are putting together a great aviation podcast in Spain. That's fantastic.
Yeah, we got some great listener mail from around the world.
Yeah, we do. If you look at the stats, quite a large percentage of our listenership comes from outside the U.S. Probably. Maybe about 45% outside the U.S. So it's aviation is international, and there's aviation geeks everywhere. All right, let's move on to some listener mail. We have, as always, we have lots and lots of listener mail, so we may not be able to get to all of it. In fact, I can almost guarantee you we won't be able to get to all of it, but everyone should know that we read all the mail that you send, and I pass that along to the other guys. So,
and actually, quite literally, when Max forwards it to us, my email is literally the first thing I check right after I get up. Sometimes I check my email in bed on my phone. That's how important this listener mail is to me.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear that. All right, first up, we have a voicemail from Steven.
Hey, guys, it's Steven out here in Southern California. Just got done listening to the newest episode of Airplane Geeks with Mikey from Buffalo Airways. I thoroughly, really enjoyed enjoyed him as a guest, and the overall topics about the DC-3s and the prop liners in general. I'm a prop liner buff, along with being a jetliner buff. But that was really cool. Hopefully, come back soon. And upon his request, I will when I get home check out the video of Rick Mercer and his dad flying the DC-3 at 15 feet up there. That sounds very interesting. If anybody's interested, JetBlue is going to be starting service from Long Beach to Anchorage, Alaska, May 23rd. So if anybody would like to go up to Alaska, I hear there are some good deals on the company for ticket prices. And I recommend anybody who's never been to Alaska to highly go, especially if you're an airplane geek. Anchorage International, Lake Hood, very big on seaplanes. I think it's the world's largest seaplane base and busiest in the world. And, of course, you have other airports in the area like Wasilla and Palmer and Merrill Field and just an overall, like, good trip to do for, like, 2 or 3 days, checking out all the airports. So that's about it. Look forward to next week's episode, whoever the new guest is going to be. And take care, guys. Bye.
The other good thing about Anchorage, of course, is if you're into spotting, specifically cargo, that's heaven right up there.
Huh.
There's a lot of traffic coming over from Asia, so.
Yeah, I would imagine, sure.
Not to mention, of course, that if you're in Wasilla, you can probably meet Sarah Palin.
I'm not being political.
Okay. Sorry, I was just being touristy.
All right. Well, thanks to Stephen for sending in that voicemail. Yeah, our last episode, 146, with Mikey McBrien from the Ice Pilots has been very very popular. Lots of downloads. I was out of town. I missed the show last Friday. It's at Friday nights, 10 p.m. This is in the U.S. Eastern. Well, 10 p.m. wherever you are, I guess. But it's on the National Geographic channel, Ice Pilots. Make sure you take a look at that.
Yeah, we got some great Facebook feedback about the episode on Facebook. So thank you for that.
Next up, we have another voicemail. This is from Jamie Dodson.
Geeks, have you been remiss? Or worse yet, have I missed an episode? I haven't heard a thing about the Sikorsky Prize. Call yourself geeks. Where's your interest in the future of aviation? Namely, the human-powered helicopter. Or, from the University of Maryland, Gamera. Hope to hear more about it, geeks. Love your podcast. Bye.
There is a competition from the American Helicopter Society. It's the Igor I. Sikorsky Human-Powered Helicopter Competition. And I'll put a couple of links to that in the show notes. We haven't talked about that. And I really don't know how that is progressing in terms of people working towards that prize. But maybe that's something that we can take a look at. And we got an email from Matthew. He sent us a little video clip called the it's about the Switchblade, quote, disposable UAV. It's kind of an interesting device. It's a little package that looks kind of like a mortar tube to me that soldiers can use and launch a little UAV that can fly around, take a look at the enemy if they're under attack or that kind of a thing, and provide data, video feeds, that sort of thing that can help these things fly for about 15 minutes. So I don't know, Dave, I don't know if you've run across this kind of thing before.
Yeah, pocket or miniaturized UAVs is becoming the norm. The military wants something eventually to be able to fly around corners and to anything to help the see the bad guys first. So big, we go from things like Global Hawks down to things the size of dragonflies. So
yeah,
miniaturization for UAVs is for the on the ground soldier in real time, giving them to be able to fly around corners or to see what's close and nearby. And the fact that it's disposable means that once it's launched and used, you're not worrying about trying to recover it. You can just
dispose
on to the next, move on to the next target.
This Switchblade is produced by this AeroVironment company. These are the same guys, I think, that produce that little hummingbird-like UAV. You know, you've seen some of the videos on YouTube. I think this actually looks exactly like a hummingbird, kind of. And it flaps its wings at a really high rate of speed. This is same company, so kind of interesting stuff. Next up is an email from Michael. He has a few quick questions. Michael asks, have any of you ever flown on planes that have been involved in incidents? I have not. I've been in a plane that was struck by lightning once, but it really didn't amount to too much. Have any of you guys been involved in any aviation incidents?
No.
I don't know. Does flying home from Georgia in a C-130 losing two engines on the way home, does that qualify?
Oh, yeah, that's definitely in the incident category.
The other one was my flight to Oshkosh in 1991 or 92. We took a Martin 404 from the Mid-Atlantic Air Museum, and we got out over western Pennsylvania, and suddenly the left of one of two engines, the right engine, lost a fuel pump. An oil pump. We had to feather it, and we went and landed and made a one engine landing, fixed the fuel pump, then took off and went back to and finally completed the flight out to Oshkosh. So I've been on two flights where I've lost engines. Hopefully I'm not a jinx. Wow.
Yeah, I'm not flying.
You've had way more engine failures than I ever had.
Michael, it was like, have we ever been experienced an incident? Was also just, have you been on an aircraft that has had an incident? So he mentioned, for example, that his family flew on the A380 that clipped the CRJ tail at JFK, but
right,
not on that flight from Johannesburg to Paris. But the only thing I can think of is about a year ago, I was on a flight, and just because I'm not as good at it as I used to be, but since I track registration numbers, I have remembered that I have flown on the same aircraft on one airline twice. And I think that's a very notable incident in aviation history, of course.
And you keep track of these things?
Not as well as I used to, and it sort of just depends on the airline, and it's sort of like, you know, at the airport, you know, what's the window situation like, where the registration number is located, but I try to.
Michael also asks if we watch Air Crash Investigation or any other aviation-related documentaries. I don't know Air Crash Investigation.
I never heard of that one either, actually, but that sounds too scary to me.
Michael, since he does ask for aviation documentary recommendations, you got to get 1-6 right at some point.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's the
Please
classic.
Please remove your shoes.
Oh, good one.
Please remove your shoes. Yes, yes, we've talked about that on the show. There's some things upcoming. Of course, there's Stephen Tupper's AcroCamp film coming up. And what's the other aviation documentary that's coming together now? A Pilot's Story.
A Pilot's Story.
Yep, that's another good one to watch for. If any of the listeners have any suggestions for other ones, you know, let us know or post them to the Facebook page. And I'll share them. All right. And then finally, Michael asked if we each have a favorite all-time airplane.
We really need to, like, make up a list of five things that we need to know, like, because we get this question a lot.
Yeah.
Like, what's our favorite airplane?
Yeah.
What's our favorite airline? Yours is a 757, Dan. That's easy.
Yes.
See, the sad part is I'm beginning to know what everybody else's favorite airplanes are.
There's actually a story behind that, but I don't think we have time. But
so, Rob, what's your favorite airplane?
Oh, man, I knew you were going to ask me that. I know the last time you asked me that, I said it was clearly the Dassault Falcon 7X.
I think that's what you said, yes.
I think, you know, David, when you sent me that picture, that F4, I went, oh, wow. So maybe we ought to
that's
have them
favorite.
Categorized by, you know, military or
yeah.
or civilian or something, because, boy, that brought back a few memories.
Yeah.
By the way, Michael, just because you mentioned it in your email, I just totally cut off Max, so I'm going to let Max answer, and then I'll...
You mean for my favorite airplane?
Yeah.
I think I said last time we did this, I think I said SR-71, and I'll stick with that.
And Max, you'll get to see one at Udvar-Hazy.
I know. I've seen one at the Pima Air and Space Museum. That was the first time I'd seen that. That's awesome.
But by the way, Michael, since you mentioned it in your email, I'm very jealous that you've gotten to ride on an Avro.
Yeah, you like those Avros, huh?
Yeah, and sadly, I mean, now if I want to ride on one day, but now I have to go to Europe because the last two airlines to operate them here, which I think were Air Wisconsin and Misaba for United and Northwest, respectively, retired them. I want to say it's at least 5 years ago now, but I'm not sure.
All right. And David, did you say what your favorite was?
My favorite, I flew home from Georgia and lost two engines on.
That was it.
A C-130.
Okay. Brad writes in and says, I just listened to episode 144. Thank you guys very much for the really thorough answer. I think Dan must actually be a 65-year-old former airline exec. Thanks again. Well, June 18th, we'll find out for sure.
June 18th.
June 18th. Airplane Geeks, live, unplugged, Udvar-Hazy at the Dulles Airport in Chantilly, Virginia. Be there or be square.
That's right. Let's see. Who's up next? Michael. Michael. We got something from Michael. Rob, I blame you for this. Michael says, too funny. This is one of my favorite internet duos, and they just came out with a cover tune for
Angry Birds.
So that goes on for quite a while, and it's actually kind of a nice little thing. But Rob, you're to blame for the Angry Birds mania.
Yeah, I know. But it was worth it to watch those guys do that little clip.
Yeah, it was fun. So thanks, Michael, for sending that in. We got an email also from Gus. Gus says, hey, guys, been listening to the podcast for a few months, and it's nice to catch up on all the airplane stuff I missed during the week. I have a question for all of you, though, whoever feels like they want to get into it the most. I recently started working with an air ambulance company, Fixed Wing, and have been keenly aware of the safety record of both fixed and rotor wing medical flights, which is horrible at best. What is your take on this? Possible fixes? Opinion of the causes? What have I just gotten myself into? Thanks for writing that in, Gus. I think I have been reading some stories about the really bad safety record of some of these operations. Have you heard that? Have you heard that as well, guys?
Oh yeah.
Any idea why?
There have been quite a few investigations already that have been opened up about EMT flying. Now, did he say he's a pilot? He's going to be a pilot for an EMT operator?
He just said he started working with an air ambulance company, but I don't know in what capacity.
Hmm. Yeah. Cause it, well, you know, it, inherently, it's a very risky operation. Look at what the air ambulance folks do. Most people, or some people may think that it's simply transporting a patient or an organ or something from one location to another. But where things get really hairy for the EMT pilots and crews is that they're often picking up people at the side of an automobile or a truck accident alongside of a road. Often when the weather is bad, visibility poor, often at night.
Flight profiles that don't ever get above 500 feet.
Oh yeah, I mean, and they, you know, it's very difficult because they're going into places that are not normally prepared landing spots. So sometimes they strike things that they weren't even aware were there, that aren't marked properly or something like that. And it's a pretty, you know, it's a pretty risky career.
I'd be interested in what's the safety record. I know Gus says it's kind of bad overall, but for rotary wing versus fixed wing for air ambulance operations.
Oh, I think
I'm sure rotary wing's worse than fixed wing.
Yeah, I can look it up here if we want while we're talking, but it's not real good.
No, it's not like it's 20 after 10 or anything, or we're all tired. But yeah,
no, that's true. Yeah,
Dan turning down raw data. Boy, it must be late.
I have to get up at 6:30 in the morning. So,
all right. Just moving on, since it is getting late, we got quite a number of emails from folks concerning our discussion last time about the 757 and its apparent, you know, speed to get off the ground and to get to altitude and compared to other airplanes. And we got some great stuff from Steve, from Ian Kershaw, from Etienne, and some of it's quite detailed and very interesting. I'm thinking that in order to do it justice, maybe we should hold off on this.
I completely agree, because especially Etienne, who's an air traffic controller,
yes,
provide a really, really great breakdown. So yeah, let's hold off.
It wouldn't do it justice to get through it really quickly. So I think we all want to thank you guys for sending in some really great information. And we'll kind of devote some time to it specifically on an upcoming episode. Okay, so I think that will do it. Thanks to everyone for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. This is episode 147. Our guest was Todd McClamrock from My Flight Blog. You can find him at myflightblog.com. Also on Twitter, same thing, My Flight Blog. Also, thanks to Steve Vischer and Grant McCarron from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast for their Australia Desk report. Also for their guest, Steve Tupper, also known as Stephen Force. You can find him at airspeedonline.com and acrocamp.com as well. And we appreciate Peter Johnson for his Across the Pond segment covering European aviation. Peter is at alphatangopapa.blogspot.com, and you can find his guest Diego's podcast at aeropodcast.com. Okay, let's tell folks where they can find us online. Rob Mark, let's start with you.
Well, they can find us at jetwine.com and on Twitter at jetwine, and the rest of the time I'm here waiting for the show to start.
and waiting for it to end.
And waiting for it to end, yes. And hey, we just want to remind people that link to the PayPal link for donating 5 of your hard-earned dollars to help Airplane Geeks make that second hour at Dulles next month. So hope you'll take part and get a button.
That's
and
right.
Get an autographed Dan out of the deal, maybe.
All right, wow. David Vanderhoof. Where do folks find you online?
You can find me on my blog at whatjustflewby.com, which hopefully this week I'll post a lot of the pictures I took at Langley. Or you can find me on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof, or you can always find me lurking on the Airplane Geeks podcast Facebook page.
Great. And Dan Webb, how about you?
You can find my blog, Things in the Sky, at thingsinthesky.com. Yes, I'm very creative. Hopefully I'll be more back to normal this week. I was kind of didn't post a whole lot because I was in the middle of finals at school, but I'm back. Anyway, you can also find me on Twitter at Dan Webbage.
Great. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me at the 30,000feet.com aviation directory or on Twitter at Max Flight.
And you can find us at the Udvar-Hazy Center June 18th. And
right,
you can find us on Facebook. We finally crossed 500 fans this week, so thank you.
Yes, we did.
And there's more. You can also follow us on Twitter at Airplane Geeks. And
and Binet, if they want to call in, what number?
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Well, you guys are making it easy for me. Anything else?
Wait. Yeah, there's more.
Right?
Call now, and we'll double that offer. You can have two Airplane Geeks buttons
for $10.
If you donate your $5.
No. We'll send you two Airplane Geeks buttons for $10, or one Airplane Geeks button for $5.
The only insane thing on this show isn't just Rob, it's this deal.
All right, I better say, join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast.
No, bye, Max, buddy. Wait, we're not done.
No, there's bye. More. All right, I think we're out. Are we out?
I hope so.
I do too. I really do.